This week on World Affairs, will democratic capitalism survive? Hello, I'm Philip Yun, CEO of World Affairs. Global inequality is surging. According to Oxfam, the world's 26 richest people currently have the same amount of wealth as the poorest 3.8 billion. Populism, some say radical populism, is on the rise. Protests from Paris to Santiago share themes of resentment and outrage towards economic policies that are seen as inherently unfair. These very public demonstrations show how citizens are losing faith in free market democracy, which emerged triumphant over communism and fascism in the 20th century. In this week's episode of World Affairs, we're considering what's at stake for liberal democracy in the coming decades of the 21st century and what might be next. Today, we talk with Larry Diamond, senior fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution and author of the new book, Ill Winds, Saving Democracy from Russian Rage, Chinese Ambition, and American Complacency. Joining him is Francis Fukuyama, a senior fellow at Stanford's Freeman Spogli Institute and author of the book, Identity, The Demand for Dignity and the Politics of Resentment. Moderating the program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. World Affairs is produced in partnership with KQED, and it's made possible by the generous support of Chevron and TPG.
Francis Fukuyama and Larry Diamond, welcome to World Affairs. The idea that we would be asking the question, will democratic capitalism survive? Just kind of in a historical terms, the blink of an eye ago, it might have even seemed like a crazy question. The world, we were told, was just getting better and better. The Iron Curtain fell. The countries living behind it since the ashes of the Second World War were cooling, now had elected leaders, apartheid unraveled without a civil war in South Africa, Indonesia sent Suharto and family into retirement. The world was not necessarily totally free, but there was freer trade and freer markets and more elected governments, and hundreds of millions of people rose from the most grinding, horrifying poverty to join a growing global middle class. So what happened? Larry Diamond?
I think that we, first of all, started running out of countries that had more favorable conditions for democratic development. That is, that were middle-income countries with higher levels of education, some prior experience with democracy, and reasonably favorable regional neighborhoods. Not less important was a change in the global picture. China arose as a global superpower over the last decade or so. We've had a resurgence of Russian power and anger and ambition in the world, and now a new generation of Russian disinformation tools that go viral very quickly to try and subvert democracy abroad and, you know, peaceful and civil dialogue among democratic forces in the world. We've had democratic decay in a variety of ways in the West, with the overambitious and I think extremely ill-advised American intervention in Iraq, which tarnished the general reputation of democracy promotion around the world, and then the global financial crisis. And globally, it's a very different picture now than it was even 10 years ago, not to mention when the Cold War ended. And that doesn't even begin to comprehend the larger scale technological and economic changes that have been going on in the world, the pressures of immigration, the resurgence of the importance of group identities, which Frank has written trenchantly about in his most recent book. So it's a very different world now than it was in the early years of the post-Cold War world.
So granted, liberties in loose soil, tenuous in a lot of places. And for every Yanukovych sent packing in Ukraine, it seems like there's a Duterte taking the Philippines who knows where. But, you know, along with every step back, it felt for a while like there were still two steps forward. In Budapest, in Brasilia, in Belgrade, democracy is still in greater supply than it was in 1975 or 1985. Is this partially a question of how you adjust the frame, the lens that you're using to look at it. Because if you look at a time frame of 50 years or 100 years, the world is still a lot freer, richer place than it was.
Well, no, there's no question about that. Of course, Ray, you know, if your metric is 1975, we've still got, you know, well over twice as many countries that are democracies now as were then. We still have no longer probably a majority of countries over 1 million that are democracies, but nearly so, which is almost twice the percentage of the mid-1970s. So it's not that the world isn't dramatically more democratic and free than it was, say, 30 years ago. It's that in recent years, the trend has been turning downward. We've been in, I think, a 12-year democratic recession in which for every one of these years, more countries have declined in freedom than have gained. And the more alarming thing beyond the duration of it is that it's accelerating in recent years. So you mentioned Duterte. I think that democracy is no longer there in the Philippines. The Philippines, I think, has to be recognized now as more authoritarian than not. The same, of course, with Hungary. We lost Turkey some years ago, Bangladesh. These are big and important swing states in the world. And of course, you know, we all see how much democracy is fighting to survive under Russian overt threat and Russian covert threat in Ukraine.
Francis Fukuyama, do you share Larry Diamond's worry, his concern that these institutions, this rising tide of liberty is suddenly imperiled, very fragile?
You know, to me, the bigger setback that Larry didn't mention is actually what's gone on in the United States and in Britain and in other developed democracies. You know, we used to have this concept of a consolidated democracy. It's like a one-way ratchet that if you become a democracy, you have two or three successful turnovers of power, then you're in and there's no going backwards. But I think what we've seen in our own country is that actually the institutions of a liberal democracy, all of the check and balance provisions of our Constitution that prevent an excessive concentration of executive power, you know, a lot of people are willing to throw those out the window if it's to their political advantage. And to me, that's always been the more disturbing thing about what's going on, because I do think that, you know, in developing countries, it's a very rough ride. Some of them will do well, some of them won't, but, you know, they need more time. In the developed democracies, it's something different, because I do think we're seeing a kind of grassroots populist revolt against the prevailing order that's, you know, quite disturbing.
Well, let's look at Britain. I want to spend a lot of time talking about the United States later in the program, but let's look at an example. You mentioned Britain. On the one hand, it's in a kind of peril right now, an existential peril. It's wondering what it is, what kind of country it's going to be, and really having an angry internal dispute about that. You can't say that they're not turning to the people and saying, what do you want? Which is one of the markers of a place where the people still rule. We may not like the outcome, but we're still asking people, what do you want?
I think the problem is what happens in societies when the people are not one people, but they're highly polarized or split into very distinct tribal warring camps. And I think that's one of the problems in Britain, that you have this new division that occurred over Brexit. But that's not the only advanced democracy that's suffering from something like this. Israel now looks like it's going to go into its third election. Spain has had a similar set of deadlocks. And so I think that in a way that's the more worrisome trend, is that there was a kind of social consensus that existed for a social and political consensus that lasted through many of the post-war decades around, you know, center-left and center-right parties. And that has now hardening into very bitter divisions where you simply can't get governments to make decisions because people don't agree on very fundamental issues of policy or of values.
So, Larry Diamond, the old idea was that if you had to have a general election out of schedule in advance of when it was supposed to happen, the idea was, like a papal ballot, eventually people would coalesce around one side or the other and somebody would prevail. But in several of these countries, and Francis Fukuyama mentioned Israel and Spain, and they're really good examples, the people go back to the polls and pretty much choose the same bunch. So you never really get a coalescence, an idea where people in supporting lower finishing parties say, okay, I will give my vote to these other people. We need somebody running the show. You get a kind of stasis, but then what happens after that?
Well, this raises an interesting issue, Ray, of constitutional structure. Britain, Spain, Israel, they all share one thing in common, or we could talk about Belgium, which has recurrently had this problem. They're all parliamentary systems. And so when you have a distribution of power of a parliamentary system. Now, Britain used to have a decisive majority because it's more of a majoritarian system. Spain, and in particular Israel and Belgium, you know, they're more proportional representation. You get a number of different parties. They've got to form coalition governments that can be hard and unstable. But with Britain now, you've had, first of all, more evenly divided opinion, as Frank has said, and then it's more distributed. There are more parties and tendencies now, including the Scottish Nationalists, Brexit, the Liberal Democrats who represent a more centrist alternative. And it's hard to form a government in these circumstances. That can command majority support in a presidential system like we have in the U.S., you automatically get a president and a cabinet, and unless there's severe presidential wrongdoing that two-thirds of the Senate will sanction, the president lasts for 4 years, so at least you get a government. But the curse there that we've seen in the United States is if you don't have unified party control over Congress and the White House, then you can get deadlock. And that's been the particular curse that we have had. So unless you deal with the underlying political cleavages or find new political incentives to generate the formation of governing coalitions that elicit compromise, it can be hard to govern democratically in any of these systems. And I will just anticipate our conversation about America by saying, this is why I so strongly favor ranked choice voting in the United States. I think it is more likely to elicit this compromise. And if Britain had adopted ranked choice voting, where you don't just vote for one candidate, in a district, but you rank your candidates 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and you keep having instant runoffs until somebody emerges with the majority of the vote, as a result of which there are no spoilers. You can vote for a non-traditional party, a third party, an independent, and not waste your vote. If somebody doesn't win a majority of the first preference votes, you keep having instant runoffs until somebody wins. If that had been adopted in Britain when they actually did vote on it some years ago, I think the Liberal Democrats would be surging in Britain now, and it would create the possibility of forming a government from the center out. Instead of the, you know, anti-Brexit extreme and the Labour Party, which has gone off a left-wing cliff, not being able to really agree on anything. But Britain didn't adopt that reform, and it stuck with an increasingly unworkable system, in my view.
Until now, until this point in the program, we've been talking about democracy and its discontents. But part of the theme of this show is also capitalism, which is coming in for kind of a hiding, coming in for a kind of critique that the triumphalist spirit of the 90s would have found incomprehensible. Even in the richest places on the planet, there are sizable constituencies that are saying, hey, this setup isn't all that. Whether it's a family paying 40 or 50% of its household income for rent, or a young person who can't pay off student loans and get some traction into adulthood and form a household, or a worker who is working arguably harder, making more value with his or her labor across the week, and standing still economically. Even in pretty lucky, pretty affluent places, people are having second thoughts, Francis Fukuyama, about capitalism.
I think that you really need to distinguish between capitalism per se, which is a very broad term that encompasses a lot of forms of economic organization, and a certain kind of extreme free market, what's called neoliberal set of economic policies, Chicago School economics, that became very popular in the 1980s and 90s. And I don't think that you can pin the inequality and other problems that we've seen in recent years on capitalism per se. Actually, I think that any capitalist system, if it's not linked to a democratic political system, is ultimately going to move in this kind of direction towards ever-increasing inequality. But that's why, you know, the market by itself is not sufficient to create a happy society. You need a political system that does things like provide social protections for people, that redistributes income, that guarantees people in terms of their health care and pensions and this sort of thing. And if you neglect that, you're going to end up, I think, where the United States and Britain have ended up, where many ordinary people are very disillusioned with the lot that they've drawn. So in a certain sense, I think what you need to do is go back to an older conception of, you know, social democracy, where you can't really maintain the legitimacy of a capitalist economic system unless it's linked to a pretty broad set of social protections. And, you know, beginning with Reagan and Thatcher in the 1980s, these two countries pretty much abandon that, at least in principle, if not, you know, across the board.
Larry Diamond, do you shiver a little bit when you hear that phrase, social democracy? Or is it something that's going to get people that you work with at the Hoover all excited?
I think we need to draw, Ray, a very sharp distinction between social democracy, which can be actually quite vigorous, innovative, creative, and growth-generating capitalism with social protection. We need to draw a big distinction between that and the boogeyman of socialism. Socialism is state ownership of the means of production. And I think that what we should be focused on is finding a balance, which is, I'd say, certainly one of the core, ongoing, relentless policy debates in any democracy, particularly advanced democracies. It will never end. How do you find a balance between keeping taxes moderate enough and incentives for capital formation, innovation, and risk-taking ample enough so you can get economic growth and new enterprises forming and the creation of new wealth? How do you find a balance between that and the need to, you know, have a rising tide that lifts all boats, and to put a floor of dignity and social insurance and, you know, minimum standards of living beneath every human being in the society? And I'd stress for the latter concern, how do you do it in a way that puts the emphasis not just on sustaining people with minimum income and a basket of goods and certainly, you know, health insurance and affordable housing, but how do you distribute to them the skills and job opportunities so that they have not just income and, you know, physical sustainability, but the dignity and excitement and stimulation of work. And part of the big challenge we're facing now, we see it, you know, in a variety of fascinating and intense ways as we sit here, Frank and I, in the Silicon Valley, surrounded by the AI revolution. Part of the challenge is, you know, how are we going to preserve and refashion meaningful and dignified and hope-generating work opportunities in the midst of the revolution in artificial intelligence, which is surely displacing a whole swath of traditional physical labor and even, clerical jobs.
Ray, I would echo that point. If you want to point a finger at a culprit that's creating the kind of inequality we've seen in the United States and in other advanced societies, it isn't capitalism so much as technology. As the computer revolution has progressed, it has become increasingly easy to substitute smart machines for human beings. This used to occur at a level of pretty routine kinds of activities, but increasingly, HR departments are getting hollowed out because computers with AI can do those functions just as well in medical technology and a whole variety of areas. And that's a different kind of challenge, because what you'd have to say is either you're going to control that technology and simply not permit it to be used, which I think is pretty difficult, or you're going to have to say, well, we really have to help people to adjust to the conditions of very different forms of work. Obviously, this means training, but I don't think you can train, you know, a 60-year-old truck driver to be a graphics designer. And so there are going to have to be other kinds of social protections that will buffer people against this rapid kind of technological change.
The discussion so far has been exactly what we need to hear, but also very much concentrated in North America, Europe, and a couple of other places on the planet. To an encouraging degree, Latin America, as more governments there are ruling with the consent of their people. But there's a whole other audience that's still kind of on the bubble, watching systems evolve around the world. And if you're mining rare earths in the Democratic Republic of the Congo that go into iPhones in China, if you are one of those places where China is building fixed capital to allow that allows your economy to grow, and they're not making the kind of demands on you for transparency and record keeping and democracy that Western investors have. They're trying to pull off the trick that from the perspective of 1989 just seemed impossible, that a massive population could move from poverty to affluence without getting that much freer. And if you're in a continent like Africa, if you're in a place like Western Asia, where a lot of these things are not settled, where political systems are unstable, but there still is a very strong desire for rapid economic progress. This is still kind of an open argument which way to go, isn't it?
I think it's not as open as a lot of people think. We actually have the benefit now of something we didn't have 25 years ago, which is a treasure trove of public opinion data from over 30 countries in sub-Saharan Africa. In some cases, countries that have been surveyed every 3 years or so, 7 times in the last 20 years. we actually have quite a good idea of what the general population of the African continent thinks. And we know, in broad strokes, Ray, the following things. As a general rule, Africans would like one half of the China model, the model of rapid economic development and rapid emergence out of poverty. The other half of the China model, which is authoritarian government that's unaccountable to the people and that violates civil liberties, they distinctly do not want. And it's not even really a very open debate among the population at large. There are debates in the societies, many of them being generated by Chinese disinformation and manipulation of public opinion as a result of their interventions and manipulations of the media and certain opinion leaders in these societies. But at the mass level, Ray, on average, two-thirds of people in Africa say pretty consistently over the last 20 years, they want to live in a democracy. And it's not just the D word. There's very, very strong support for independent media, independent judiciary, term limits for presidents, a strong accountable presidency that has to be answered to and be checked by the Congress and the courts, and other precepts, not just of democracy, but liberal democracy. And while the government of the Democratic Republic of Congo may be willing to hand over the country's natural resource wealth to Chinese state or pseudo private corporations, and while Belt and Road Initiative lending is building a lot of infrastructure, there's a lot of ambivalence among African populations around this. In some cases, yes, they like the roads and the bridges and so on. In other cases, they don't get finished and the people get resentful and they see a lot of the corruption that's emerging out of this, and eventually they wake up to pretty significant increases in their national debt as a result of these Chinese investments, which are not being given to them. They're being lent to them at commercial rates.
I think that we should not let ourselves off the hook too easily, because part of the reason that China seems like a attractive alternative to the West is that the West has really not been good at providing developing countries with the kinds of things like roads, electricity, ports, and so forth that they really need to develop themselves. And so, you know, it's very hard to tell an African country that desperately needs, you know, an electrical grid that you shouldn't take this Chinese offer just because, you know, you may end up over indebted or it's going to produce corruption. You know, they'll say, well, we simply need it and you're not providing it. And so I really do think that Western countries need to up their game in terms of actually being able to do things that promote the economic growth of poor countries.
You're listening to the weekly program of World Affairs. It is produced in partnership with KQED. I'm Philip Yun. We're hearing from Larry Diamond, senior fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution and author of the new book, Ill Winds, Saving Democracy from Russian Rage, Chinese Ambition, and American Complacency. And Francis Fukuyama, senior fellow at Stanford's Freeman Spogli Institute and author of Identity, The Demand for Dignity and the Politics of Resentment. Moderating the program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. To hear this program or any other World Affairs program, you can download our podcasts on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs. That's one word. And now back to our program.
If I'm sitting in an African capital reading, a widely distributed magazine in French or in English, and there are several that are pretty straight up, and I see breakneck speed growth in Ethiopia, which in the recent past has not really been a functioning multi-party liberal democracy. I see all kinds of improvements in schooling and infrastructure and inward investment in Rwanda, which, despite the fact that Paul Kagame is celebrated and feted around the world, is following the authoritarian model as well. If my country hasn't been matching the progress in those places, am I going to conclude that a robust, dynamic parliament with a lot of people arguing back and forth about options for the future is the way to go?
Well, this is a really interesting point you make, and it's worth then looking at what's been happening politically in Ethiopia and Rwanda as a result of these periods of rapid growth. In Ethiopia, there was widespread public protests, many of them violent, and eventually the toppling of the prime minister and the rise of this new reformist prime minister, Abiy Ahmed, who has promised, we'll see if he can deliver, to bring democracy to Ethiopia. Why would there have been political instability and widespread protests when there was this rapid period of economic growth? And the answer is, in the absence of democracy, you had a narrow ethnic group dominating the political system. And there was widespread feelings of marginalization and resentment. It's not only economic development that people care about. People do care about freedom as well, as Amartya Sen has stressed from his work on India and development as freedom more generally. The failure of the previous Ethiopian government to attend to this led to growing political instability. What you say about Rwanda actually needs to be doubled down upon. This is a republic of fear. This is a regime that tracks down its opponents in Europe and South Africa and murders them. And there is kind of a cauldron bubbling beneath the surface of resentment at this style of governance, but he can't really express it now. And so the problem is sometimes you don't see the underlying tension until, as in Ethiopia, it blows up. The other point to be made, Ray, is you're right about Ethiopia and Rwanda in terms of pure levels of economic growth. They've been very impressive in the last decade, or in the case of Rwanda, more than two decades. But you got to look at all the cases. You can't cherry pick a couple. And if you look at some of the other authoritarian regimes in Africa, like Zimbabwe and the DRC, and you'd compare all the growth rates of the authoritarian regimes in Africa with all the growth rates of the democratic, or at least somewhat democratic, governments in Africa, you find what the economist and former State Department chief economist at Georgetown University, Steve Radelet, has found and written about, that actually the democracies of Africa as a group have performed much better in economic development than the authoritarian regimes.
That's reassuring to hear, because I want to turn now to a very, very old democracy that always thinks of itself as a young place. But really, when you look at its constitutional order, it's one of the oldest places on the planet, and that's the United States. We have a president of the United States who railed against NAFTA, scorned the EU, scorned it even as the president of the Russian Federation does. As cooperative world action seems less likely on climate change, he moves away and gives support to Jair Bolsonaro, who questions whether cooperative ventures on trying to reduce emissions really are worth all that much, and tells the world to mind its own business as the Amazon is burning. America has been sort of a wild card, hasn't it, Francis Fukuyama?
I think it's actually worse than that. The United States was really responsible for creating the entire post-war liberal international order, both the economic institutions like the WTO and GATT, and the political ones like NATO and the various security treaties we have with Japan and Korea and other countries. There's a theory in international relations that says that the only way you're actually going to get to this kind of global cooperation is if there's one country that's so dominant that sees it in its interest to create this kind of an order and therefore is willing to make the kind of sacrifices that are needed to sustain it. And that's pretty much, I think, the role that the United States played for, you know, 50 years after the end of World War II. Now, I do think that it's probably inevitable, especially after Iraq and Afghanistan, that a lot of Americans have decided, you know, is it really worth it to fight these endless wars and send our troops to these distant places where it doesn't seem like we're accomplishing anything particularly useful. But I think that the danger we face right now is that you could see a wholesale collapse of that system into a much more chaotic global order in which authoritarian countries like China and Russia are going to rush to fill the vacuum. It's not as if there's going to be lots of nice cooperation in the UN apart from the United States, you know, playing an obstreperous, obstructive role. There are clearly countries that want to move the international system in their direction. And that's, I think, the real danger that we face is that now that the United States seems to have checked out, you know, other countries are taking account of that and they're making very, very different calculations.
Taking that point that the United States is no longer willing to make to its own people the value proposition that having this role in the world pays off for the U.S. And certainly, given Iraq and Afghanistan, it's a harder case to make. But Donald Trump has even questioned the value of garrisoning bases in South Korea. He's questioned the value of having defended, under Article 5, the countries of NATO, questioning whether we really would live up to our Article 5 responsibilities and have the United States go to war in order to protect some of the smaller, less prominent members. Does that throw more water on the already dying embers of the willingness to shoulder this kind of international duty? Larry Diamond?
Well, that equivocation and lack of firm rhetorical, moral, and diplomatic support for the key pillars of the post-World War II liberal order is, as Frank was saying, immensely destabilizing. And to have President Trump articulating or allowing any doubt about our willingness to honor our commitment under the NATO treaty to defend any of our NATO allies who might be attacked opens a really serious danger. We have to make very clear to Vladimir Putin that we will go to war to defend any NATO ally. And if you don't do that, then the whole ball of string begins to unravel. And Vladimir Putin will pick off one vulnerable peripheral state after another. And it's the symbolism of the solidarity of the NATO alliance that, as much as anything, has the deterrent effect. And the fact that you could have a piece of a non-NATO ally, so let's be clear, it's outside the NATO treaty, there's no treaty commitment, but a democracy that's Western-leaning, young and forward-looking, that has some of its eastern territory, Ukraine, under Russian occupation, whereas we've heard in the congressional testimony in the impeachment hearings, Ukrainian soldiers are dying on a weekly basis trying to defend their country from Russian aggression, and that badly needed American military assistance, economic assistance, and diplomatic support could be held up by the President of the United States in pursuit of narrow partisan political advantage, I think is alarming in terms of the deteriorating geopolitical balance in the region.
Francis Fukuyama, is part of that possible because America is a more divided place than it has been in previous generations? And in this, using this kind of identity lens that you've been writing about and studying about?
I think that there's no question that the single biggest weakness of the United States now is the degree of polarization of the society. It means that we can't carry out routine functions of government, like passing a yearly budget, you know, in some kind of regular order. It means we can't address issues like immigration reform or healthcare reform or a whole range of things that in a well-functioning democracy really ought to be subjects of consensus. And, you know, the polarization is spreading into virtually all aspects of the way we're governed. And so you have a lot of pretty professional nonpartisan agencies like the Fed or like NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Aerospace Administration, you know, being attacked for being politicized when they're really not. All of this, I think, is very destructive of good government because, frankly, the United States needs professional expertise. It needs people that run the mechanism of government on a day-to-day basis, and they don't do that simply calculating what the partisan outcome of their actions is going to be, but they do have some broader sense of public purpose. And finally, I would say the polarization creates this huge foreign policy vulnerability that Russia in particular, but also to an increasing extent China, are simply walking through. You know, Russian disinformation is not the old-style propaganda. What the Russians do is simply to repeat and accelerate things that Americans themselves are saying, whether they're, you know, right-wing conspiracy theorists or Black Lives Matter activists. The Russians simply amplify things that Americans are saying about each other. And that is simply done in order to increase the degree of lack of confidence in American democracy, in the legitimacy of our political system. So I think, you know, that is the single greatest weakness we have right now.
Well, they've figured out something that was, well, you know, I guess if you're in looking at it dispassionately as someone who's observing a competition or rivalry between states, they figured out something that was pretty important, that we were vulnerable to that kind of thing, to the magnification of splits and tears in the civil fabric that already were there and just exploited it. They went to school on us and figured out what worked. I'm not going to write them a love letter or a one of admiration, but it is pretty effective and incredibly cheap.
Oh, definitely. I think they've leveraged a overall pretty weak strategic hand extremely effectively and figured out how to make the most of their assets like social media to get what they want. But you're right, it doesn't take a complete genius, although I would say that the Russians were quite innovative in seeing that. They were the first, they're way ahead of the Chinese, I think, in this respect, and kind of understanding how this can be used to weaken their rivals.
So they know us just enough to be dangerous. Well, Larry Diamond, how do you come back from that? Or are we on a one-way trend line that leads to some very bad places?
We're on a bad trend line, but it's important that we be practical and resolute and think creatively about how to climb out of the hole that we are falling into. I think that there are social media responses, including ones that we need more vigorously to see happening from the social media platforms whose algorithms are calculated to reward and sustain a high profile online for polarizing and sensational posts wherever they're coming from. You know the old saying in the media, Ray, if it bleeds, it leads. And that's kind of the mentality of social media exponentially.
Well, maybe for the 21st century, we should say if it screeds, it leads.
Well, there you go. Thank you very much for the amendment. They need to be more transparent and responsible in what they elevate, even if they're going to let a lot of this false information somehow still circulate on their platforms. But, you know, they're not just, you know, facilitators. They are publishers, and they have a role similar, I think, to prior generations of utilities, and they need to be better regulated as such, many of us are coming to believe. Beyond that, Ray, I repeat again, we have to get at the polarizing dynamics in our political system from multiple angles. One is the social media angle. Another is the kind of raw material of our daily interactions and the growing incivility, you know, even in personal interactions and inability to talk to one another. And of course, you were with us at our experiment in deliberative democracy. You saw it live, America in One Room, where we tried to bring a random sample of the American people together to talk about the issues in civil fashion, without highly polarizing partisan triggers, and with a norm of mutually respectful listening. So another initiative we can think about to climb out of this deep hole we've fallen into is, can we find ways of promoting on a larger scale? I think we can, through online deliberation, through enlarging this kind of technique and taking it into the school system, mutually respectful listening and engagement based on some common, you know, shared basis of information, which we used to have when people were watching the NewsHour and CBS Evening News and so on, and didn't have so many narrowcasting, polarizing alternatives on broadcast media. They had more of a common shared basis of information. So can we recover some of that? And then can we look at the incentives that are being generated? I think the perverse incentives by our current type of electoral system, which is presenting two choices and only two choices to the general election after candidates have been nominated in increasingly polarizing, low turnout party primaries.
You know, I'm glad you brought up America in One Room, because if you listen a great deal to people who worry about America's civic future, and then you contrast what those people are writing and saying about the state of play with what actually happened in those conference rooms over 4 days, where people who were statistically a cross-section of the United States, racially, economically, regionally, politically, were able to stay in close contact with each other across a very long set of days, talking in deep and serious ways about the problems facing the country. And those conversations did not resemble the kind of elbows out, snarly, snarky stuff you see on social media. And it wasn't because this was some special group of 550 goody two-shoes that weren't like regular Americans. They were America in One Room, statistically. And they were able to pull it off. And I came away from that with a great deal of optimism, and then made the mistake of signing back on Facebook.
Well, you know, my favorite quote of all the people I interviewed is, they were leaving that remarkable experiment, American One Room, was from a woman who said, you know, what an invigorating experience this had been, that she was able to articulate their views, her views, and have others with different points of view listen to her. And then she said, on Facebook, people just call me names. So maybe we need to find ways of having civil conversations about our politics and our political differences and how we might pursue compromises on some of these issues that bypass the sewer system that is much of social media dialogue today.
And Francis Fukuyama, you know, as tribal as the United States has become, there are similar splits in societies across the world, whether in Brazil it's regional and often based on color and national origin as well, in a highly immigrant society like ours, whether it's based on ethnic group and language in places like Cameroon and Uganda. There are a lot of places wrestling with the kind of splits and tears we are in the United States. And you have to wonder whether there's a road back, whether we all in our various countries, in our various situations, have it within us to step back from the brink.
Well, I think if you are living in a democracy, there's one clear way of stepping back from the brink, which is to have an election. Because an electoral check on, you know, a populist leader is the most effective check there is. I would say the other thing to keep in mind is that the world as a whole is really not that bleak a place. If you look at things that have been happening all over the world in the last 4 or 5 years, you have Ukraine, you have Nicaragua, you have Armenia, you have Sudan, you have Algeria, you have the liberalization in Ethiopia, you have Hong Kong. All of these places, I think, demonstrate that populations really do not like authoritarian government. They may not be able to agree on what replaces an authoritarian government, but they know that they don't like living under a dictatorship. And so I think that, you know, the spirit of democracy that Larry wrote about is really not dead. It's out there. And I think we need to show solidarity with people around the world that are pushing for that. That's why, for example, we've done a lot with Ukraine, because that's, I think, one of the foremost battlefields of this struggle against authoritarian government globally. So don't give up.
But haven't people also headed to the ballot box, whether out of disappointment, whether out of fear, whether out of just a nasty, angry time in the national life, and put authoritarians in power using the vote?
Well, sure. But I think you still need to put this in a little bit of perspective, that it's not as if having these kinds of setbacks is new. I mean, throughout the 20th century, we were constantly having big setbacks to democracy, much bigger than we've experienced in the last decade. The 1930s was not a great decade for democracy. And we still managed to, you know, recover out of that. So I think that, you know, the issue is to understand that we still have agency, that this is not an inevitable trend, that authoritarian government is not inexorably on the rise, and that people can put a stop to it by going out in the streets, by protesting, and ultimately by voting.
And Ray, if I may, if you're looking for some glimmers of hope, we can look to some recent elections where actually people are, against great odds in some cases, turning back populism. The most hopeful one was in the recent Turkish municipal elections, where the liberal opposition party won the two biggest cities in Turkey, Istanbul and the capital, Ankara. And the increasingly authoritarian ruler of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, was really dealt a stinging defeat. And then Viktor Orban lost to his party the municipal race for mayor of Budapest. And the left-wing populist party, Syriza, was defeated in Greece by a more center-leaning, pragmatic, and I think liberal in terms of its democratic values party, the historic moderate right-of-center party, New Democracy. So we are seeing that, you know, populism can also exhaust people and their patience with corruption and violations of their civil liberties, and we can turn the corner on this.
Well, as we close, I'd just like to get a quick take from both of you before I say goodbye on what the near future holds to make sure that the worst of the prognoses that you've written about, that you've talked about in your recent scholarship, doesn't come to pass. Are there places in the world that we should be watching closely for the outcome and looking at them as possible harbingers of where we're headed?
I think the single most important place where you're going to see a future trend is actually here in the United States and what happens in the election a year from now. You're not supposed to be too partisan on these shows, but I really do think that it's an extremely important election, because if you reelect a president that wants to take a wrecking ball to all of these international institutions, if he is legitimated by being reelected, that wrecking ball is going to go through. I mean, I don't think NATO will exist, you know, by year 8 of a 2-term Trump administration. Conversely, if there's pushback, I think that's going to give a lot of comfort to other people struggling against populist leaders. So that would be the one thing I would look to.
And Larry Diamond.
Yes, well, I certainly agree with all of that. And Ray, I would just add a point of emphasis from Samuel P. Huntington's great work on the third wave of global democratization in the late 20th century. The commitment of the United States to promoting democracy abroad and the inspiration and example of American democracy working and improving was very important to the success of democracy globally. So I think another really crucially important battle is for, building on what Frank said, American foreign policy, and to recover, you know, at the high level of our diplomacy and our messaging, what we're continuing to do more prosaically day by day through the work of our diplomats, our U.S. Agency for International Development, and our National Endowment for Democracy to promote democracy abroad. But if I can conclude on a positive note, it's not just in sub-Saharan Africa. Elsewhere in the world, we do still see the people, that there is no broad international groundswell of support for authoritarianism in principle as an alternative system of government. People would still like to live in freedom. They'd still like to have the ability to hold their rulers accountable and to choose them and replace them in free and fair elections. And what we have to do is show that that kind of system can work to meet people's needs and respond to their anxieties acceptably well, and that the established democracies of the world can renew their health as examples worth emulating.
Gentlemen, thank you both. Larry Diamond, great to talk to you.
Thank you, Ray.
Francis Fukuyama, always a pleasure.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to World Affairs. We are more than a program. We're a nonprofit membership organization that is dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Please join our community and visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Larry Diamond, senior fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution and author of the new book, Ill Winds: Saving Democracy from Russian Rage, Chinese Ambition, and American Complacency, and Francis Fukuyama, a senior fellow at Stanford's Freeman Spogli Institute and author of Identity: The Demand for Dignity and the Politics of Resentment. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our producer is Jared Sport, and our executive producer is Joanne Jennings. I'm Philip Yun. Thank you for joining us.